Penguin Random House Audio presents Catastrophe Ethics, How to Choose Well in a World of Tough Choices. This is the author, Travis Reeder. To my family, thank you for providing me with a little corner of the world, free from catastrophe and full of joy. May I be the tiniest nail in the house of the universe, tiny but useful. Mary Oliver, Upstream Selected Essays. It's hard to be good, and it's getting harder. People who try hard to do the right thing always seem mad. Stephen King, The Stand. Modern life is morally exhausting and confusing. Everything we do seems to matter, but simultaneously, nothing we do seems to matter. My friend, an outspoken environmentalist, recently posted to social media a picture of herself on a beautiful beach, celebrating a moment of quiet with nature. And predictably, the internet being what it is, within a few moments of posting it, one of the first comments came in. How much carbon did you emit to go on your vacation? The implication, of course, being that she's a hypocrite, preaching environmentalism for thee, but not for me. And despite the comment seeming like a childish jab, she, like most of us, cares about justifying her actions. And so she responded, citing all the ways she minimizes her carbon footprint and arguing that never getting to enjoy her life seems like an unreasonable standard. This sort of debate plays out in my head, with me playing both sides regularly, many times a day if I let it. This morning at breakfast, I poured almond milk on my cereal, which is the result of a judgment I made years ago when I decided that cow milk is too environmentally expensive to justify. In general, animal-based foods have a higher carbon footprint than their plant-based counterparts, and so I have, to varying degrees over the years, reduced or eliminated them from my diet. But while working on a recent food ethics project, I learned that almond milk might not be a great substitute. Although it does have a lower carbon footprint, almond trees require huge amounts of water, like 12 liters of water to produce a single nut. And more than 80% of the world's almonds are grown in California, which suffers from severe drought. Switching from cow milk to almond milk thus traded a high carbon footprint for high water use. So I sat down to research soy milk and oat milk to see if I could learn which was the least harmful product, ultimately deciding that none of them are perfect, but that all plant-based alternatives are superior to cow milk. To some degree, it seems to matter which milk I use, since it contributes to huge problems like climate change and water scarcity. That's why companies advertise their green bona fides when they have them. But then again, we're just talking about a little milk on my cereal. Should I actually stress about this? Doing so starts to feel a bit precious, a bit obsessive, a bit righteously focused on my own purity. I also drove to the gym today, which reflects many ethically relevant decisions I've made about my life. I live in the suburbs, which means I have to own a car and drive most places I want to go. Making this choice supports a lifestyle popular in America that is very bad for the environment, one of spread out individualism, in which so many of us live in big houses with big monocrop lawns, driving our private cars that carry only us as single passengers to do every minor task. My drive to the gym, or my 45-minute commute to campus, is a reminder that I'm part of a radically unsustainable cultural choice. I do, however, try to minimize the effect of this lifestyle by owning an electric vehicle and driving it rarely. I work from home when I can, and most trips are less than 10 or 15 miles. So I've responded to the sense of being implicated in a problematic structure by trying to minimize my participation in it. But I know it's not a perfect response, and so I feel moderately guilty about my suburban home and my private car. Participating in a broader consumer culture also seems to carry moral weight. I just received a book I ordered in the mail, and I have complicated feelings about that. Online shopping is phenomenally convenient, but it comes with costs. I would have preferred to support one of my favorite local bookstores, even though that would bring with it some extra driving, but I didn't have time to make the trip, from here in the suburbs, of course, before I needed the book. And while that means I didn't need to make a trip, the delivery person did, coming all the way to my home to deliver a box with just a single book. I have no idea how to feel morally about all of the various components of this small consumer decision. Even our entertainment decisions are not left untouched by such moralizing. In recent years, there have been extensive debates about the appropriateness of deplatforming or boycotting problematic artists. In the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement, it became clear that some previously beloved actors, directors, comedians, and other public figures were deeply problematic people. Some of them not only sexually harassed or assaulted women, but did so for years with impunity, becoming unbelievably wealthy and powerful the whole time. When we learn this about someone, should we stop consuming their products? It feels like we should, though it's a bit hard to articulate why. If I stream a stand-up comedy special through Netflix, it's not likely that an artist or their financial backers would notice that I viewed their product, nor would my refusal to watch have any measurable impact on them. And some people argue that we should separate a person from their art. After all, if someone is a misogynist or racist, it's not clear that this makes their art less beautiful, funny, or entertaining. But watching does seem to support them in some way, even if they wouldn't notice, and that feels morally problematic. A similar point came up in late 2022 when Qatar hosted the FIFA World Cup. The matches making up the World Cup are some of the most watched events in the world, with an audience numbering in the billions. Even those of us who don't closely follow soccer, or football, as our international friends would have it, are drawn into the high-drama matches. But the 2022 matches were shadowed by significant controversy. When Qatar won the bid to host the Cup, it had nowhere near the infrastructure necessary for such a massive event. As a very small country, approximately 80% the size of Connecticut, Qatar needed to essentially build an entirely new city in which to hold the tournament, including stadiums, hotels, restaurants, and transportation. But with a population of only 300,000 Qataris, the burden of this work fell on the millions of migrant workers brought in from Asia. In recent years, it has become clear that this system of employment was widely abused, with immigrants working long hours in the blazing heat and then living in stifling, unsanitary housing camps. A report by The Guardian concluded that in the decade after being awarded the World Cup hosting rights in 2010, more than 6,500 migrant workers from South Asia died in Qatar. Although FIFA and Qatar dispute this number, there are ample reports of atrocious living and working conditions, making it clear that whatever the precise number of people who died from the attempt to rebuild a nation in just over a decade, it was a terrible burden that fell on a vulnerable population. So should none of us have watched the World Cup? I certainly felt the pull in that direction. To watch was to support FIFA's and Qatar's decision to build a city in a desert with exploited migrant labor, which predictably caused terrible suffering. But at the same time, no one cares whether I watch or not. When billions of others are watching, my choice is insignificant. And the World Cup is a cultural phenomenon that carries a lot of meaning for many people. Should a Lionel Messi fan really be expected to give up watching his last dance in order to take some sort of righteous stand? We could continue digging up cases, but the basic context that makes up the confusing ethics of today is the following. Many of us feel an individual responsibility to address massive collective problems despite an inability to act in ways that have a meaningful impact on those problems. We, as a global society, must address climate change. Doing so is an absolute moral requirement because it is already causing devastation, with the worst yet to come. As a result, I feel some responsibility not to contribute to climate change and to be a force for positive change, even though, realistically, my contributions either to the problem or to a solution don't seem meaningful. The problem is too big, and my contribution is too small to make a difference. I'm torn between the pull of a kind of purity that I should keep my hands clean by withdrawing from problematic activities and a sense of nihilism, that it doesn't matter what I do, so I should get over myself and just live my life. So what is each of us to do? How do we live a morally decent life when we can't even get our arms around the problems? That's the central question of this book. The psychologist and philosopher Joshua Green thinks the human brain is like a camera. It has an automatic, fast, easy to use, not very versatile, setting, and a manual, slow, effortful, but versatile setting. Similar to the psychologist and economist Daniel Kahneman, Green thinks that this leads us to make different kinds of judgments in different situations, and that this extends to moral judgments as well. just like we have fast intuition.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?